My name is Justin Michael. I am part of the Hoboken Grace skydiving team, and I'm here to invite you to be part of this with me. We are working our way towards Nationals, which is going to be held in Arizona this year, but we have a huge problem in that there's not enough skydivers from Hoboken Grace to actually form a team. So we all need you to just go out right now and just start planning for your first skydive. I just want you to put a plug in for that. I don't know. It's really going to work out. Anyway, I'm really glad to be with you. I've been traveling a ton for my job recently, and it's great to be back here at home with my family, and it's wonderful to be here with you at Uptown Hoboken, and I'm just so thrilled to be here. And I want to just echo what was said earlier. If this is your first week with us, we're thrilled that you're here. We're honored that you're spending your time with us. We hope that you're making yourself right at home. And you've come at a great time. We're in the middle of a series which we're talking about called His Church. And Javi spoke really eloquently to this issue that we're talking about. Because something that Jesus intended to be incredibly beautiful, something that Jesus intended to be wonderful, sometimes gets in the way of the mission. And you heard Javi talk about his hesitation to go and be part of church because of the expectations, because of what that meant to him, the subtle things that meant to him. And so we're talking through the good and the bad, the beautiful and the ugly of his church. And what can cause us to derail something, again, that I said before, that God intended to be so beautiful that can become ugly. Something that God intended to be an encouragement to people can become a deterrent. And last week we had a great conversation about incarnation. Incarnation, the belief that God says, you know what, separation between you and me, it's not good enough. I don't want the separation between us. And so God became one of us. That's what incarnation is. God became one of us to help us find our way back to him, to help restore our relationship with him, to help bring us back into the family. And because we're on this mission with God, because we get to be on this mission with him, we get to be part of that. We get to be a part of incarnation. And we ended it last week talking about this really powerful image. This powerful image that says, if they will know that Jesus is with them in their darkest moments, if we are with them in their darkest moments, we have to be there to be hold back their hair when they puke. That's a really vivid image. How about it for this week? Did any of you get splashback? It makes me really nervous because, you know, when I was a kid and somebody, oh boy, I could rarely hold back. But this message of incarnation is so critical. And this week we're going to talk more about incarnation. We're going to talk more about what does it mean to be there in those darkest moments, and what do we do while the sun still shines. And I want you to think about this with me, because we know we've got to be there. We've got to be present. But being present is not enough. In fact, being present, sometimes we can actually hinder the mission. By being present, we could actually hinder the mission. Can you think with me about how that might be? One of the things I thought of was that when we judge people and enforce on them our ethics, our morals, our decision about how we think people should live their lives, and make that a condition for us loving them, that's one way in which we can be present, but we can hinder the mission. What are other ways? I was thinking of distance. Where sometimes you might be physically present, but you might be emotionally distant. You might remove yourself from the situation because you didn't want splashback. You didn't want your reputation to be sullied by being known to be interacting with them. But that's not how Jesus acted. Jesus was incarnate. He was in it with us. He was there in those darkest places. But it's more than that. It's more than that. Because sometimes we can be in those moments with them, but then there's no difference. We're incarnate, we're present, but there's no difference. And one of the ways that I think that plays out is when we start following a different God, not the God Jesus Christ, but a different God. And I'm going to use a really archaic word here. The word is idol. And it's kind of a bizarre word to use because most of us, when we think of the word idol, we think of something physical, like a statue or a bust or a tree planted on the side of the road or a totem pole. When we think of the word idol, we oftentimes think of these physical things. But I don't really know of a better word to describe something that we follow, and we are going to sacrifice lives to, because we feel like it's going to give us a sense of fulfillment, it's going to give us our peace, or it's going to give us joy, but it doesn't. It's empty, and it can't fulfill us. And so when we're present, but we're not actually promoting the mission, but we're hindering the mission, I think it's in those moments that we are following some idol, some false god. And those false gods are all around us. When we are actually present, when we're actually engaged with people, we're going to encounter them as they chase their idol. There's something that they're obsessing about. There's something that they believe will give them peace and joy and love. There's something that they're putting their confidence in. It could be accumulation. It could be wealth or power. Or it might be food or sex or entertainment. It might be relationship or family. But there's something that they're pursuing that they feel is going to fulfill them. And when we're present in their lives, we need to be ready. Ready to replace that idol with the real God, with Jesus Christ. I can think of one instance in my life where there was no difference in me. I was present, but there was no impact because I was just following along. This woman named Ruth was telling me about her life. She's telling me about how hard her life was. See, her husband had passed away, and she was struggling. She was struggling to keep up with the things at home. She was struggling to keep up with the yard work and all the things that he used to do. She was struggling to maintain and make sure ends met. She was struggling financially. She was struggling emotionally. She was lonely. She missed him. But as she was telling me about this dark place in her life, she kept saying this one thing over and over again. She kept saying, "These challenges are a blessing." And then she'd smile. She'd say, "It's a blessing to have this challenge in my life. I'm grateful for this blessing of a challenge." And I kept thinking to myself over and over again, she's denying the pain that she's feeling. She's pretending everything is okay. And I regret that at that moment, I just followed along. I tossed in my own empty words about how challenges are a blessing. I didn't give her any comfort. I didn't do anything or say anything to remind her that God was pursuing her, that God loved her, that God cared about these situations and his heart was breaking for her. I was present. I was actually hindering the mission because I was just reflecting how she was talking. I think it's important for us that we need to recognize that we sometimes are just reflective. We reflect the people that we're with. And we like that. It's part of being a social person. And those of you who are introverts, I want you to know you're reflective too. You're social too. It's just that your crowd's a little smaller than those of us who are extroverts. But we're reflective. And when I'm with you, I feel cooler. And when I'm with you, I feel smarter. And when you invite me along, I think to myself, okay, now other people will think that I'm smart or cool. And you all know I need as much help about being cool as I can get. So I'll take every inch I can get. But we're reflective. We're in those situations and we just want to be part of what's going on. And so sometimes we'll sacrifice a life to the God, to the idol of being included. When guys are sitting around talking about their wives, how much trouble they are, for a little bell rings in our head that says, it's okay. The bar's been lowered, but it's okay to talk about our families like that. Or when gossip is happening around the water cooler, something happens and we think for a minute, it's okay to be part of this. It's okay to get involved in this conversation. We think for a second because we're reflective. We want to be included. And instead of making a difference, instead of being different, we blend right in. Now, I want to talk to you about how we can have an impact. I want to talk to you because it's more than just being present. It's more than just being present. We actually have to have an impact. And one of the ways in which we can have an impact is by building a reputation. And what do I mean by that, building a reputation? What I mean is that I want you to start thinking about how you can live a questionable life. How can you live a questionable life? Now, I want to let you in here for a second. I'm going to let you inside the story a bit because I'm going to tell you, I'm going to let you in on the inside joke here. This is a wordplay because usually when we think about a questionable life, we go, oh, why did he do that? I have a story like that where one day I was driving to my friend's cabin in the middle of the woods, and I was driving down country roads, and it was about 10 or 11 o'clock at night, and there was this huge thunderstorm. I mean, it was just raining cats and dogs. And as I was driving my motorcycle down these roads I'd never been driving before, boom, the headlight on my motorcycle blew up. And the only time I could see the road ahead of me was when the lightning flashed. And for a second, I could get a glimpse of what was going on ahead of me, and then it would be dark again. And I kept going. What was I thinking? That's what you think of when you say living a questionable life. Yeah. But it's a wordplay. It's a wordplay because what I want you to think about when thinking about living a questionable life is this question, why did he do that? I want us, when we live a questionable life, to make people turn heads and go, what was going on? Why did he care? Why did he get involved? How is he benefiting from this? Because so often when people are chasing these idols, they're chasing these things, these empty things, because they think it will bring them fulfillment, and we do something radically different, it makes them turn their heads and look and try to figure out what's going on. I want to read to you a couple passages about that and give you some specific examples. Jesus says this. He says it to his disciples. Love each other. Just as I have loved you, you should love each other. Your love for one another will prove to the world that you are my disciples. Jesus is saying, hey, this is how I want people to know about you. This is what I want your reputation to be, that you love one another. Later on, Paul, now remember who Paul is. He's that guy who was trying to destroy the church. He was putting people in jail. He was having them killed. But then suddenly, he became one, and he became a huge advocate for being a follower of Jesus Christ. Well, this is what he wrote. Three things last forever: faith, hope, and love. And the greatest of these is love. And we believe that Jesus demonstrated his love for us when he was incarnate, when he came and became one of us. But he was more than that. He made people question why. He had a reputation. And what was his reputation? That he would take care of people. That he would heal people. That he wasn't afraid of the splashback. But he was ready to be there, to be present in people's lives. And I want to give you an example of somebody who is like that in my life. Because I think that's what, if we're on this mission with God, that's what we're called to do. We're called to be Jesus for them, to communicate who he is to them. So my Aunt Carol Ann, I want to tell you about my Aunt Carol Ann because she really exemplifies both being present and building a reputation of living a questionable life. And she had a huge impact on my life before I even knew her. I think before I even met her. One day my Aunt Carol Ann and my uncle and her daughter and their daughter were in the car. And they had stopped at a railroad tracks, I think. I think it was the railroad tracks where they had stopped. And all of a sudden their car was crashed into by another car. And my cousin Beth was killed in the car accident. And my aunt and my uncle were terribly, terribly hurt. And the man who caused that accident, eventually he would go to jail for driving while intoxicated. But it was too late. The damage had already been done. Beth was dead. And my aunt and my uncle were terribly hurt. And in the midst of grieving for the loss of their daughter, in the midst of trying to recover from their terrible injuries and from the incredible pain, you know, they did something remarkable. They reached out to that man. They found out who he was. They called him up. And some of you in your mind think, yes, I can see how you might be able to forgive him from a distance. You might be able to forgive him for the terrible thing that he did. But they went beyond that. They brought him into their lives. He became part of the family. And not only him, but his children too. And they treated his children like their children. They treat them like they treat their own children. They love them. They take care of them. They're walking alongside of them as they go through life together. They're both present, and they're building this reputation. Can you imagine how you would feel to know the man who killed your daughter is coming over for Thanksgiving dinner? And while he's in jail, you are communicating and spending time with his children, listening to them talk about what's going on in their lives. And it hasn't stopped. They're still involved in their lives. They're still together. My aunt is still communicating and spending time with that man's children. She hasn't stopped loving. She's building a reputation. And people question it. They're like, how can you do that? How can you love the man who did that to your family? How can you love the children of the man who did that to your family? It makes people question. It makes people ask a question where the only possible answer is Jesus Christ. It's the only possible answer. They're building a reputation. And how would it be for you? How would it be for you if people who never met you would hear about your good works? How would it be for you, people who didn't know you, would know you by this reputation of the extravagance of your love? You know, the early church had a reputation too. Luke, now we've been reading through the letters that Luke wrote. Luke wrote some letters, and he had done a careful study of Jesus Christ and the things that the early church had done, and he wrote about them. And in one of the letters he wrote, we read it in a book called Acts. And this is what he wrote. A deep sense of awe came over all of them. And the apostles performed many miraculous signs and wonders. And all the believers met together in one place and shared everything they had. They sold their property and possessions and shared the money with those in need. They worshiped together at the temple each day, met in the homes of the Lord for the Lord's Supper, and shared their meals with great joy and generosity, all the while praising God and enjoying the goodwill of all the people. And each day the Lord added to their fellowship those who were being saved. I want to point out to you three critical things from this passage. The first thing I want to point out is what were they doing? They were taking care of the needs of those who had less. They were being generous to make sure that nobody went without. That was one of the things that they were doing. The second thing that I noticed is that as a result, they were developing a reputation. The passage says they had the goodwill of all the people. Notice here, it doesn't say necessarily that only the people inside of their little group, but it says of all the people. They had developed a reputation for doing good. And the third thing that I noticed from this passage is it was having an impact. Each day, the Lord added to their fellowship those who were being saved. It was having an impact. Luke goes on and he writes more about this in chapter 4. He says, all the believers were united in heart and mind, and they felt that what they owned was not their own, And so they shared everything they had. The apostles testified powerfully to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's great blessing was upon them all. There were no needy people among them, because those who owned land or houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles to give to those in need. Wow, that's extraordinary. There were no needy among them. Why? Because they were even willing to sell their property and their land in order to provide for those who didn't have enough. Later in chapter 5, Luke writes again, all the people had high regard for them. They were developing this incredible reputation. This reputation for amazing acts of love. This reputation for taking care of people. Now, this passage that we're reading, these three passages that we read, they're from really early on in the church. The theologians call it the primitive church. It was just so disorganized, I guess, at that time. It was primitive. But we see later on that this continued. In fact, somebody who wrote about it is actually kind of extraordinary. His name was Julian. Now, Julian was the Roman emperor. He was Caesar, about 300 plus years after the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And we're going to read what he has to say. He wrote this, why do we not observe that it is their benevolence to strangers? Wait, I have to quick explain a few things. This passage is really going to bake your noodle. We're reading this passage from his perspective. Now, this is a man who's not a follower of Jesus Christ. So he's going to refer to the followers of Jesus Christ as promoting atheism. He's going to say, oh, well, they don't follow my gods. They're following this other weird god. And so he's going to refer to them as atheists. He's going to refer to them as impious. He's going to refer to their purity as sort of fake, pretended. From his perspective, he didn't trust them. And so that's why this passage has that weird spin to it. So let me read it to you. Why do we not observe that it is their benevolence to strangers, their care for the graves of the dead, the pretended holiness of their lines that have done the most to increase atheism? Again, his belief. For it is disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, the impious Galileans support not only their own poor, but ours as well. All men see that our people lack aid from us. Teach those of the Hellenic faith to contribute to the public service of this sort. So here's this guy. He's Caesar. He's the emperor of Rome, and he sees what these Christians are doing. He sees what these followers of Jesus are doing, and he's aghast. And he says it's promoting atheism. It's making people move away from his belief set to another one. Why? Because they're taking care of the needy. And not just the needy, not just the Jewish people who were in need, but the Roman ones as well. By this time, the Christians had finally caught that vision. And we got that last week when we listened about Peter and how he caught the vision that his reconciliation is not just for the Jewish people, but it's for the whole world. And so Peter caught that vision, and we see that play out here. 300 years after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, they were still having their reputation build for doing good, for doing things that just are confusing, like why are they taking care of the Roman poor? Why do they care about them? Why are they involved in their lives? We should be doing that. But they're taking care of it. Why? They were living questionable lives. Peter calls us to that in his own letter, right? Peter's one of those guys who that first sense of the questionable lives, like, what are you doing? But this is what he writes in his letter. Now, who will want to harm you if you are eager to do good? But even if you suffer for doing what is right, God will reward you for it. So don't worry or be afraid of their threats. Instead, you must worship Christ as Lord of your life. And if someone asks you about your Christian hope, always be ready to explain it, but do this in a gentle and respectful way. Keep your conscience clear. Then if people speak against you, they will be ashamed when they see what a good life you live because you belong to Christ. This passage is the passage on which our entire strategy as a church is based. Our entire strategy is based on this, that we're going to do good, that we're going to have an impact on the community around us, and we're going to love them in ways in which make them say, why? Why do they care? Because it's not enough to be incarnate. It's not enough to be present. But you have to be building that reputation, a reputation of living a questionable life, a reputation that makes people ask why, and the only answer is Jesus Christ. We have to be Jesus. We have to be Jesus at that party at 2 a.m. We have to be Jesus at the water cooler. We have to be Jesus in the grocery store, at the game. We have to be there. We have to be incarnate. We have to say, yes, I'm one of you. I'm a fan. I'm a Hoboconite. I'm a husband. I'm one of you. But as we live life together, I want you to understand how it is to experience and encounter Jesus Christ. We have to be ready to give that opportunity to replace the idol that they're obsessing over with the true God of Jesus Christ. I want to give you some examples of how that might look. It might be that you express how you're comfortable with singleness because you believe the idol of relationships to be a lie and an empty promise. That might be one way. Or maybe it's because you communicate that you don't earn money in order to hoard it, but so that you can see how much of it you can give away. That you love your wife not just as an equal, but as somebody that you're going to pour yourself into, somebody that you're going to honor, somebody that you're going to give your life for. That we're not going to follow under the god and the idol of accomplishment and be crushed by expectations of success, but instead we're going to be freed. Freed to follow the God of grace and love. These are just a few examples of what it would be like, what we would be doing in those dark moments and in those moments when the sun is shining. We would be developing a reputation for living a questionable life, and when people ask the question why, the answer is Jesus Christ. And I think it's important for us as we go through this process to actually talk to God about developing our reputation, to actually have a conversation with him about what does he want to see in our lives, to talk to him and say to him, help me to see how I can be building my reputation. And maybe that's too strategic for you. Maybe it just needs to be really tactical and just say, Father, help me to see the opportunity to love today. Help me to have the courage to love the people I encounter. When I came to New York, I was taking the subway to work. And one day, on the subway, I saw this kid. He was about 13 years old, and he kind of reminded me of me at that age. He was kind of dirty. He looked really disheveled. And he had a haunted look in his face. He looked miserable. And I wanted to say something to him. I wanted to tell him that he wasn't alone, that God was pursuing him, but I lacked the courage. And I didn't say anything because I was afraid if I made that gesture of love that he might reject it and say something angrily back at me, and as a result would embarrass me in front of that car full of people who were on their way to work. And so I didn't say anything because I was afraid. At that moment, I was following the idol of safety. And I regret that I never said anything to him. And so recently, I was flying from Kansas to New York. And it was that week, a couple, 3 weeks ago, where we had these really bad storms in the Northeast. And so all the airports were shut down. And so after 24 hours and four different flight cancellations, they finally found a way for me to get from Kansas to Kennedy, where I would have to pick up a taxi in order to get a ride home. And I was going through Minneapolis. I'd never been to Minneapolis before. I don't think I've ever flown in or out of that airport. And as I was sitting there, I was sitting next to this boy, and his name was Sam, and he and his brother and his sister were going to Minnesota to go to camp. Their mom had decided to send them to Minnesota to camp so that she could go to Texas for the summer. And so that was the plan. And Sam had never been on the plane before, so he had a ton of questions. And me, I love to fly, so I had a ton of answers. Even though I don't always land with the plane, I still like to get in them. And I was happy to answer his questions. But as we were flying from Kansas to Minneapolis, I was kept saying to God, what do you want me to say to this boy? To remind him that you're pursuing him. To let him know you care about him. To let him know you love him. And I couldn't think of anything to say. I couldn't think of a lead-in. But I remembered what happened in that subway car. And so as I was getting off the plane, I gave each kid $20. You know, when you're at camp, it's nice to have a little cash in the pocket to go to the cantina. I like to eat Skittles, and so that's probably what I would have done with my $20 at 13. I didn't have any words for him, but I did something. Something to communicate, hey, there's love in the universe. Somebody cares about you. And when I walked off the plane, his brother looked at me like I had three heads. He could not figure it out. Why did I care? Why did I do that? Why did I give him $20? He couldn't figure it out. It made him ask the question, why? It made him ask the question, why? Earlier, I asked you to think about what idols we see in the universe, what idols we see as we rub shoulders with people. What do we see them pursuing with their whole heart that is sacrificing some life to some empty promise that's not going to fulfill? But now I want you to dream. Dream with me about what Hoboken will look like when we have our reputation for loving people in extraordinary ways. Dream with me, what can we do as a family to have an impact on Hoboken, to have an impact on our community, on our neighbors? You already do an incredible job. You may not know this, but you have an incredible reputation. When you put on that Easter egg hunt, you do a phenomenal job. People from all over come to be part of this incredibly well-run, professional Easter egg hunt. And they have a blast. And people come from all over and stand in line early so they can be part of it. You do that with such excellence and such open hearts. We have a reputation for one day when we go places and we just go and do service projects. Why do we care about how it looks at the cemetery? Why? You have an incredible reputation, and I just want you to keep dreaming. I want you to keep envisioning new and more ways in which we can express the love of Jesus Christ to our neighbors, to the people of Hoboken, to the people of Jersey City, and just show them that we're living these questionable lives. We get to be incarnate. We get to be part of their lives. And now I want you to dream about what it's going to look like as we live questionable lives. Will you pray with me? Father, first I just want to say how grateful I am that Jesus Christ did not wait, did not sit idly by when we were in our dark, deep places, but that you became one of us. You became one of us to bring us back to yourself. You became one of us to bring us into the family. Thank you for that amazing gift. And I hope, Father, that you, now that you've included us in your mission, I hope that we see opportunities to love in extraordinary ways. I hope that we see opportunities to love the people of Hoboken, to love our neighbors, to love our families in ways that make them say, why? In ways that make them question. Help us to abandon behind the idols we're still serving. Instead, work for the mission. Help us to be not only incarnate, but to be building a reputation for you. Thanks so much for your amazing love, and we'll talk to you again soon. Amen.